This podcast contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Creepy Cannabis Podcast, where we chat all things creepy, cannabis, true crime, paranormal, and weird. I'm Madeline.
I'm Rachel.
And we're back.
Hello. It has been the most eventful week of my life.
Yes.
We got into a car accident Thursday night? I don't know. I'm on a lot of medication, Joe. I'm going to be 100% with you.
It's fucked up.
But we, had to swerve to avoid something that flew off of a truck. I'll be honest with you, I was, scrolling Spotify, looking for the best song, and then all of a sudden, I hear, it's not funny, but, we survived, but, I hear a sound, the car jerk, and I look up and see, that I'm headed, the guardrail, I'm pretty close to it, but, I'm heading at it kind of head on, and thankfully, the vehicle was able to turn just enough that it, hit the guardrail and, kind of skimmed it, so, without my medication, I'm real stiff and it's very hard to move, but thankfully I didn't have any long-lasting or serious injuries. When it first happened, obviously, my adrenaline was crazy and I was, at the ER and I was, waiting for a billion years and they never saw me. So then the next morning rolled around and I was if y'all don't give a fuck, fine. And then I went to Express Care and they're the ones who treated me.
Oh my God.
I know. But it was a total loss, so we have to get a new car. But it's, really tricky because basically, our insurance will give us a rental for, we'll say, 5 days. Which then obviously puts you in a position where you have to buy your vehicle within that amount of time. But because it happened on a weekend, and because I was literally just in a fucking car accident and don't have the capacity to, be sprinting around the U.S. of A. looking for a fucking car.
That's annoying.
And also, how much down payment? It's just too hard being an adult. So anyway. That's the exciting story for me.
Ugh.
This week.
Unpleasant.
Yeah. And then I know we already told you guys that Maddie graduated, but on our Instagram, she posted a picture of the sash we talked about in the part one of this episode. So you should go check that out and follow us on Instagram because shameless plug. That's why.
At Creepy Cannabis Pod.
Oh, yeah. I guess I should tell you where.
Yeah.
Listen, it's... I'm on, I'm just on, 800 milligram ibuprofen, but I'm on a muscle relaxer called, I don't know, cyclobenzaprine, maybe?
Oh. Yeah.
And I've been given that a couple times in the past, and every single time I've ever taken it, night-night, bitch. The minute it's ingested, I'm, drooling on myself. Okay. I want to know what we're smoking today, because my water pipe is packed, ready to go.
So... this strain is called Orange Drizzle. It is a cross between the strains Mimosa and Wedding Cake, and it's really sativa-leaning hybrid.
It smells good.
The top terpenes typically in the strain are limonene and myrcene. This one definitely has twice the limonene compared to myrcene, so more sativa-leaning.
Okay.
Hybrid.
So is myrcene the active ingredient in indica?
Active ingredient in indica strains. It's just a terpene that's more sedating and relaxing.
Okay, so and because
it's an indicator of indica-leaning strains.
Okay.
But there's other cannabinoids that cause sleepiness, CBN and stuff like that, that more indica-leaning strains tend to have higher amounts of as well. But limonene is energizing and uplifting.
Because I want to puff it and enjoy it while you describe it, please.
So, and it's really freaking citrusy.
It smells very strong citrus.
When it's burning, it smells like orange.
You can smell in here, you get a burnt smell too, but you can smell straight up orange and then burn smell.
Yeah, wow.
Isn't it weird?
It's really, really citrusy.
Yeah, it's really potent.
And it's... you know, its claims to fame is that you can taste the citrus all the way through to when you're smoking it. It is a great option for pain relief or muscle stiffness.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Also, I just want to clarify that I am past when I was due to take my next muscle relaxer, and mm-hmm. I didn't take it because I am partaking, and I didn't want y'all to think this. I was over here just acting buck wild, okay? That's all. I just wanted to set a good example. Carry on.
And this is 30% THC. So it's pretty high testing. Strain.
The citrus flavor is very strong.
It's very similar to the strain Clementine in flavor and scent.
It tastes, honestly, it tastes like orange cleaner. Like, it tastes how orange glow smells.
Mm-hmm. Very citrusy.
Well, you guys will get to experience my downfall. See how she does.
But yeah, it tastes really good.
And that, my friends, is that?
That is that.
That's that? Okay. That's cool. So, thank you for hanging in out with us. I want to tell you before we get started that I know this is kind of rude to do because I'm not going to tell you the whole thing, which is like a dick move, and I get that. But Maddie and I have something extremely exciting coming up in July for us and for you. Yes. And so, make sure that... I know, summer gets busy, road trips, travel, but you should make sure to be listening to our podcast so you don't miss anything important or exciting. I mean, we're exciting, but more exciting. And that is all. Plus, July is my birthday month, so, like, low-key, it's kind of rude if you don't listen for my birthday.
May I have that later?
Thank you. You may. Thank you. You may. So, sorry for my anxiety, but obviously, like, last week's episode was stressful, and this is a, like, continuation, so I'm just, like, preemptively knit. But this is our continuation to the Houston mass murders, part two. So this is basically the fallout. So where we left off, Dean Corll was murdered by Elmer Henley because he tried to kill his friends, his two friends, and this is kind of after. So... Elmer's now in PPD custody, and he was questioned about the killing of Dean. He went over the events of the previous night and that morning, and he basically explained it was in self-defense. And then Timothy and Rhonda's statements corroborated his account, so he didn't lie about that specific account. And they believed, they were like, great, you killed him in self-defense. That guy was crazy. Cool. They questioned him about his claim that Dean had threatened him that morning and that he had shouted that he had killed several boys, and Elmer explained that for almost 3 years, David and he had helped procure teenage boys, some of whom had been their own friends. And they procured them for Dean, who had raped and murdered them. And Elmer gave a verbal statement stating he initially thought the boys he had abducted were to be sold into the Dallas-based organization for homosexual acts, sodomy, and maybe later killing.
Okay.
So either way, you knew they were likely going to die. But he soon learned that Dean himself was actually killing the victims they were bringing back. Elmer, he never once, like, by all accounts lied. He just, like, straight up was like, yeah, we're going all in. So he admitted that he learned... that he had assisted Dean in several abductions and murders, and that he had actively participated in the torture and mutilation of 6 or 8 victims prior to the murder. Most victims had been buried in a Southwest Houston boat shed, like we had talked about previously, with others buried at Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach. Dean did, in fact, pay $200 for each victim David or he was able to lure to his apartment. So he kept his word. Police were skeptical of Elmer's claims, assuming the sole homicide of the case was that of Dean, which they ascribed as being the result of drug-fueled fisticuffs that had turned deadly. You couldn't see it, but I was air quoting. Please hold, I need some water to swallow this bullshit. My goddaughter, every time she takes a sip, does that thing, and now I can't stop. It's so fucking cute. I'm one of those people who thought kids were absolutely fucking vile until she came around, and I'm like, what do you mean you don't want to look at the 47th picture of her in the last 10 minutes, Maddie? She's adorable. And it's, I get it. I know nobody gives a shit. Because I once gave no shits about it. So, anyway. They thought it was these fisticuffs. They were duking it out. They were bopping and socking. And then boom, boom. That's what they thought. I'm concerned. However, Elmer was pretty insistent. And he kept going and kept going until he eventually named the last names Cobble, Hillegess, and Jones. And he stated that he and David had procured them for Dean, and the police accepted that there was something to his claims, as those three teenagers were listed as missing at the Houston Police Department headquarters. So once he started bouting off those names, they were like, oh shit, we have to do our jobs. Fuck, he named people we've heard of. Mm-hmm. Because dead ass, if I'm an investigator and somebody comes up with a story like this, every single time I'm fixing to investigate. I'm like, oh my god, let's go see. They were like, shit. Shit, Robert, we gotta clock in and put this coffee down and go do our jobs. Carrying on. So anyway, they were like, oh shit, he's telling the truth. Hillegess had been reported missing in the summer of 71, and the other two boys had been missing for just 2 weeks, so they were more recent victims. Moreover, the floor of the room where the three teenagers had been tied was covered in thick plastic sheeting. So, the room where, Elmer, Rhonda, and Timothy were, like, right before the death, or before the shooting, had plastic sheeting. They also found a plywood torture board measuring 8 feet by 3 feet. With handcuffs attached to nylon rope at two corners and nylon ropes on the other two. They found, at Dean's address, large hunting knife, rolls of clear plastic of the same type used to cover the floor, a portable radio rig to a pair of dry cells to give increased volume, an electric motor with loose wires attached, 8 pairs of handcuffs, a number of dildos, thin glass tubes, and lengths of rope. Okay. As per usual, I'm going to give you a second trigger warning because we are going to get into a lot of grape conversation. Dean's Ford Ecoline van was parked in the driveway and it had a similar impression to inside. So the rear windows of the van were sealed by opaque blue curtains. In the rear, they found a coil of rope, a swatch of beige rug covered in soil stains, and a wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides. The pegboard walls inside the rear of the van were rigged with several ring hooks. Another wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides was found in Dean's backyard. And inside that crate, they found several strands of human hair. So, don't know. I don't know if that just went over their heads. Kind of gave me vibes of the girl in the box one. Colleen Strand.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of that. Sorry, I'm so freaking thirsty. Elmer agreed to accompany police to Dean's boat shed in southwest Houston, where he claimed the bodies of most of the victims could be found. Inside the boat shed, the police did find a half-strip stolen car, a child's bike, a large iron drum, water containers, 2 sacks of lime, like lime you use to dissolve, and a large plastic bag full of teenage boys' clothing. Two prison trustees, which are just, from what I could figure out, are like prisoners on work release, began digging through the soft, crushed shell bottom of the boat shed. So it's just like an earth bottom, essentially. And they soon uncovered a body of a blonde-haired teenage boy lying on his side, encased in clear plastic, and he was buried beneath a layer of lime. They continued excavating through that, like, soil there, unearthing the remains of more victims in varying stages of decomposition. Most of the bodies were wrapped in thick, clear plastic sheeting, and some victims had been shot, others strangled, and the ligatures were still wrapped around their necks, like they never even took them off. They just buried them as they were. Okay. Mm-hmm. Every single one of the victims found had been sodomized, and most victims found had evidence of sexual torture. This is your trigger warning. So they had their pubic hairs plucked out. Their genitals had been chewed on.
Okay.
They had
objects inserted into their rectums and glass rods had been inserted into their urethras and smashed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Cloth rags had also been inserted into their mouths, and adhesive tape was put around their faces to muffle their screams. So they probably couldn't fucking breathe. The tongue of the first victim that they uncovered protruded over 1 inch beyond the tooth margin. And then the mouth of the third victim, who was unearthed on August 8th, was so, like, open that all the upper teeth and lower teeth were visible, like, completely visible with the, like, your gums back, or your lips back, and it led investigators to theorize that this child had died screaming.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. After the recovery of the eighth body from the boat shed was completed at 11:55 p.m., the investigation was discontinued until the next day. I'm sure everyone slept great that night. And then accompanied by his father, David, so remember David, he was the initial boy that Dean had groomed from, like, the sixth grade that was the first one to help him with his abductions, mm-hmm. who has the pregnant fiance.
Okay.
So, David and his dad came to HPD headquarters on the evening of the 8th and gave a statement in which he denied any participation in the murders, but admitted to having known that Dean had raped and killed two boys in 1970. On the morning of the 9th, Elmer gave a full written statement detailing his and David's involvement with Dean in the abduction and murder of numerous boys. In this confession, Elmer readily admitted to having personally killed approximately 9 boys and to have assisted Dean in the strangulation of others. He stated, the only 3 abductions and murders David had not assisted him and Dean with were committed in the summer of 73. That afternoon, Elmer accompanied police to Lake Sam Rayburn, where he, David, and Dean had buried 4 victims killed that year. 2 additional bodies were found in shallow, lime-soaked graves located close to a dirt road. Inside the lakeside log cabin owned by Dean's family, police found a second plywood torture board, rolls of plastic sheeting, shovels, and a sack of lime. Police found 9 additional bodies in the boat shed on August 9th. They were recovered between 12:05 p.m. and 8:30 p.m., and all were in advanced state of decomposition. The 12th body that they recovered had evidence of sexual mutilation. Basically, the severed genitals of that victim were found inside of a sealed plastic bag placed next to their body. Another one of the victims had several fractured ribs, and the 13th and 14th bodies unearthed before identification cards, had identification cards, as Donald and Jerry Waldrop, the brothers who were killed together, not the ones who were killed separate from each other.
Okay.
I don't know, like, cause I feel like if Elmer never said anything, like, neither of these guys would be in jail. Like, they would just be living their lives, carrying on, hopefully not being psychos, but he was just like, you know, fuck it, we're all just gonna go down today. I'd be low-key pissed if I was David. I'm like, bro, you did not have to do us like that.
No, he didn't.
David ended up giving a full confession on the evening of August 9th, admitting to being present at several killings and assisting in several burials, although he continued to deny any direct participation in the murders. In reference to the torture board upon which Dean had restrained and tortured his victims, Dean stated, once they were on the board, they were as good as... Oh, I'm sorry, David stated, once they were on the board, they were as good as dead. It was all over, but the shouting and crying. In reference to the actual murders, David stated his witnessing the victim's death didn't bother him, adding, I saw it done many times. He agreed to accompany police to High Island Beach to assist in the search for the bodies of the victims. I just think it's weird how neither of those boys gave a shit. They were both like, eh, they were dying. That was interesting.
Okay.
Excuse me. On August 10th, 1973, Elmer again accompanied the police to Lake Sam Rayburn, where 2 more bodies were found. They were buried just 10 feet apart. As with the 2 bodies found the previous day, both victims had been tortured and severely beaten, particularly around their heads. That afternoon, both Elmer Henley and David Brooks accompanied police to High Island Beach, leading police to the shallow graves of 2 more victims. On August 13th, both men again accompanied the police to the beach, where four more bodies were found, making a total of 27 known victims. At this time, this was the worst killing spree in American history, which is not surprising.
No.
Elmer initially insisted that there were two more bodies to be found inside the boat shed, and that the bodies of two more boys had been buried at High Island Beach in 72.
Creature. Stop.
He acts like he gets no attention.
He's everywhere.
At the time, the killing spree was the worst case of serial murder in terms of the number of victims in the United States, exceeding the 25 murders attributed to Juan Corona, who had been arrested in California in 1971 for killing 25 men. The record number of known victims attributed to a single murder case set by Dean and his accomplices was surpassed only in 1978 by John Wayne Gacy, who murdered 33 boys and young men and who admitted to being influenced by press coverage of the Houston mass murders to cuff his victims prior to their abuse and murder. Which was interesting because as I was researching this and that you were talking about some of the scenarios, I was like, oh, I remember Gacy, like, would do that handcuff trick too.
Great.
Yeah. So.
He was foul.
Correct. Family of Dean's victims were highly critical of the HPD, which had been quick to list the missing boys as runaways who had not been considered worthy of any major investigation. The families of the murdered boys asserted that the police should have noted an insidious trend in the pattern of disappearances of teenage boys from the Heights neighborhood. Other family members complained the HPD had been dismissive of their adamant insistence that their sons had no reason to run away from home. Everett Waldrop, who was the father of Donald and Jerry Waldrop, complained that shortly after his sons had disappeared in 71, he had informed police an acquaintance had observed Dean burying what appeared to be bodies at his boat shed. In response, the police performed a perfunctory search around the boat shed before dismissing the reports as a hoax. So, Waldrop stated that on one of many occasions when he visited the HPD, the police chief had simply told him, "Why are you down here? You know your boys are runaways." So, The mother of Gregory Malley Winkle stated, "You don't run away from home with nothing but a bathing suit and 80 cents," because her son was literally in his bathing suit. So, in May of 1974, 21 of Dean's victims had been identified, with all but four of the boys having either lived in or had close connections to Houston Heights. So literally they weren't paying attention at all because they all almost had connections. Two more teenagers were identified in 1983 and 85, one of whom, Richard Kepner, also lived in Houston Heights. The other boy, Willard Branch, lived in the Oak Forest District of Houston. So again, at least one more person that was abducted from the area. On August 13th, a grand jury convened in Harris County to hear evidence against Elmer Wayne Henley and David Brooks. The first witnesses to testify were Rhonda Williams and Timothy Curley, who testified to the events of August 7th and 8th, leading to the death of Dean Corll. Another witness who testified to his experience at the hands of Dean Corll was William Rittinger. I don't know if you remember, he was the one who was released. That I think David convinced him to release him, and he was like, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. After listening to over 6 hours of testimony from various people, on August 14th, the jury initially indicted Elmer Henley on 3 counts of murder and David Brooks on 1 count. Bail for each was set at $100,000. The district attorney requested that Elmer Henley undergo a psychiatric examination to determine whether he was mentally competent to stand trial, but his attorney, Charles Melder, opposed the decision, stating the move would violate Henley's constitutional rights. Which sounds dumb, because he probably would have gone off then. By the time the grand jury had completed its investigation, Elmer Henley had been indicted for 6 murders and David Brooks for 4. So Elmer Henley was not charged with the death of Dean Corll, which prosecutors ruled on September 8th had been committed in self-defense. So that one was just like, yeah, well, he got what he got. So at least they did that right. They were like, eh. Okay. So Elmer and David were ultimately tried separately for their roles in the murders. Elmer was brought to trial in San Antonio on July 1st, 74, charged with 6 murders, like I said, that were committed between March 72 and July 73. The prosecution called dozens of witnesses, including Curlian Rittinger. Rittinger testified that at Dean Kroll's home, he was tied to the torture board and assaulted repeatedly by Dean before he was released. Other incriminating testimony came from police officers who read from Elmer's written statements. In one part of his confession, Elmer had described luring two of the victims for whose murder he had been brought to trial, so two of the victims that he was indicted for, Cobble and Jones, to Dean Kroll's Pasadena residence. Elmer confessed that after their initial abuse and torture at the home, Cobble and Jones each had one wrist and ankle bound to the same side of Dean's torture board. The boys were then forced by Dean to fight each other with the promise that the one who beat the other to death would be allowed to live. After they spent several hours beating each other, Jones was tied to a board and forced to watch Cobble again be assaulted, tortured, and shot to death before he himself was again raped, tortured, and strangled with a Venetian blind cord. Cobble and Jones were killed on July 27, 1973, 2 days after they had been reported missing. Several victims' parents had to leave the courtroom to regain their composure as police and medical examiners described how their relatives were tortured and murdered. And I'm sure they did, because all of these, like, most of these people were killed, like, not right after they were taken. So if they didn't keep saying they were runaways and had at least made an effort, there's a chance they could have been found before they were killed, because they were all held and tortured for at least some time, for the most part. I'm going to say, I can't blame it on that strain of weed, because I've had a lot, but my mouth is so dry. The cotton mouth is so fucking severe right now. Okay, let me get myself together. Throughout the trial, the state introduced 82 pieces of evidence, including Dean's torture board and one of the boxes used to transport the victims. Inside the box, police had found hair, which examiners had concluded came from both Cobble and Elmer Henley. Upon advice from his defense counsel, Elmer did not take the stand to testify. His attorney, William Gray, cross-examined several witnesses but did not call any witnesses or experts for the defense. On July 15, 1974, both counsels presented their closing arguments to the jury, the prosecution seeking life imprisonment, the defense a verdict of not guilty. In his closing argument to the jury, District Attorney Carol Vance apologized for his not being able to seek the death penalty, adding that the case was the most extreme example of man's inhumanity to man that I have ever seen. The jury deliberated for only 92 minutes before finding Elmer guilty of all six murders to which he was tried. The following day, July 16th, formal procedures to sentence Elmer Henley for the six guilty verdicts began, and on August 8th, Judge Preston Dial ordered that he serve each 99-year sentence consecutively, totaling 594 years, and he was transferred to the Huntsville unit to formally begin his sentence. He appealed his sentence and conviction, contending the jury in his initial trial had not been sequestered, that his attorney's objections to news media being present in the courtroom had been overruled, and citing that his defense team's attempts to present evidence contending that the initial trial should not have been held in San Antonio had also been overruled by the judge. His appeal was upheld, and he was awarded a retrial in December of 78, a big part of that being as a result of the publicity of the case and the fact that he had to be tried in San Antonio, and that if he had been tried elsewhere, he would have been able to get a more fair jury, because everyone at this point knew about what had happened in this neighborhood. the retrial began on June 18th of 79. This second trial was held in Corpus Christi, with Henley again represented by defense attorneys William Gray and Edwin Pagelow. His attorneys again attempted to have his written statements ruled inadmissible. However, Judge Noah Kennedy ruled the written statements given by him on August 9th of 73 as admissible evidence. The retrial lasted 9 days, with Elmer's attorneys again calling no defense witnesses and again attacking the credibility of Elmer's written confession. Which I don't understand, because it didn't fucking work the first time. The defense also contended the evidence provided by the state belonged to Dean Kroll, not Elmer Wayne Henley. So basically, how the torture board was made and used by Dean, like, it wasn't, in his mind, it wasn't fair that they brought that to court. On June 27, 1979, the jury deliberated for over 2 hours before reaching their verdict. Henley was again convicted of 6 murders and sentenced to 6 concurrent 99-year terms. Hmm. So, he be rotten.
Yeah.
He be rotten. excuse me. Please hold. I'm so dry.
I'm also quite thirsty. Didn't bring any water, though.
We are literally almost done, though.
It's okay. I'm gonna survive.
Okay. Will you?
No.
As I drink last up. David, okay. David Brooks was brought to trial on February 27th of 75. He'd been indicted for 4 murders committed between December 1970 and June of 73, but was brought to trial charged only with the June 73 murder of 15-year-old William Ray Lawrence. David Brooks' defense attorney, Jim Skelton, argued that his client had not committed any murders and attempted to portray Dean Corll and Elmer Henley as being the active participants in the actual killings. Assistant District Attorney Tommy Dunn dismissed the defense's contention outright, at one point telling the jury, "This defendant was in on this killing, this murderous rampage, from the very beginning." I also feel like that's a violation of his rights for a judge to tell a jury that.
Yeah.
But what do I know? He tells you he was a cheerleader, if nothing else. That's what he was telling you about his presence. You know he was in on it. Brooks' trial lasted less than 1 week. The jury deliberated for just 90 minutes before they reached a verdict. He was found guilty of Lawrence's murder on March 4th, 1975, and sentenced to life imprisonment. David showed no emotion as the sentence was passed, although his wife burst into tears. David also appealed his sentence, contending that the signed confessions used against him were taken without his being informed of his legal rights, but the appeal was dismissed in May of 79. So, currently, where we are, Elmer Wayne Henley is serving his life sentence at the Mark Stiles Unit in Jefferson County, Texas. Successive parole applications dating from July 1980 have been denied, and he's next eligible for parole in October of 2025. David Brooks served his life sentence at the Terrell Unit near Rosharon, Texas. He actually died of COVID-19 related complications at the Galveston Hospital on May 28th of 2020 at the age of 65. So David Brooks is buried at Captain Joe Byrd Cemetery in Walker County. And that is that.
Wow.
It's all she wrote. In the words of Arnold Schwarzenegger in the new Netflix hit show, FUBAR, that I loved, that's it and that's all. That show is actually really good, low-key. It's like, it's good if you set your expectations. It's like silly, mm-hmm. stupid, funny, and he makes fun of himself a lot. Like, he definitely says the word chopper way too many times when mm-hmm. he could say something else.
Mm-hmm.
Cute stuff like that.
Okay.
So, not sponsored because Netflix does not know who we are.
Oh, they certainly don't. We just got banned from just trying to use Venmo.
Yeah. They said absolutely not, you canna hoes.
And, yeah, apparently if you have cannabis in the name of your business,
you can.
I mean, I already should have done that immediately.
We should just name our business Creepy Podcast, and then, like, the cannabis is, like, for our, like, we put it where we can, but, like, our legal business name. I don't know.
Let's see what Venmo does.
Venmo's going to tell us to fuck all the way off.
I'm going to ban my whole account.
Yeah. Maddie's hook one for the team on this one. We'd stay and chat longer, but our throats are so dry, we may pass away. So, bye.
Thank you, and bye.